Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right.
That's George Carlin, of course, describing the basic condition of our citizenship in these United States at this early part of the 21st century. It's a stark contrast to the way we think of ourselves as free Americans. Ellen's latest article on the origins of American oligarchy opens with that ownership line by Carlin as she traces the arc of monetary history and the victory of capital over democracy. Hi, I'm Walt McCree. And today's It's Our Money program focuses again on the dominance of money power and how people are attempting to push back. Ellen's guest today is Carl Herman, an educator on government and economics. And we'll also hear about an effort to get America's mayors to acknowledge the financial harm that Wall Street banks have inflicted on their municipalities. We'll also be hearing from Matt Standard with the Public Banking Report. But now, let's talk with Ellen Brown.
Ellen, you wrote an article this week called How America Became an Oligarchy. And it speaks right to George Carlin, how we opened our show, with how we are owned and the illusion of our democracy. And, you know, you've come out and described this as being a traceable historical event. Walk us through your logic of how America has become an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, what prompted me to write it was a Princeton University study that just came out and said that America is no longer a democracy, that we're actually an oligarchy, that decisions are made by big money, big corporations and big banks specifically. So then the question is why that happened, how we lost our democracy, if we ever had it, and how we might get it back, if at all possible. Another thing that prompted me to write it was, well, first of all, I have to speak next week, actually, on our democracy and elections and third parties. And I'm supposed to speak at John Cobb's conference on a similar subject. And he wrote a really good long article on tracing how we lost our democracy. So I cited him in this article. And he goes back to the 17th century, or to 1694 is when the Bank of England was founded. And before that, the crown actually issued the money, and then Parliament took over, so Parliament had control, and the crown no longer had control. So they no longer allowed the king or queen to issue the money, and so the king had to borrow. So then the king got into a war.
King William needed money to fight a war. He had to borrow, and then at that point, then the government became a borrower. And as you say in your article, became the servant of the lender. That was the crux, right? That was the point.
Yeah, so that was the beginning. But the American colonists didn't go along with that. They issued their own money. They didn't borrow from the Bank of England. They didn't have gold and silver, so they would have had to borrow if they were going to use the official money. But instead, they issued their own paper script, a very clever system that they originated. I mean, they were the first to do it as paper money. Of course, before that, there were the tally sticks and so forth. Then King George said that the colonists could no longer do that, and then we had the American Revolution, which some authorities say was fought because of this right to issue the national money supply. So we fought the revolution, but the problem was then the currency so devalued, the continental currency so devalued during the war. We won the war with this currency that was just printed paper money, but by the end of the war, it was pretty much worthless, largely because the British had counterfeited. But anyway, the founding fathers were so disillusioned with paper money that then they reverted to gold as the official currency, but they didn't have the gold. I mean, there was a limited amount of gold. The government didn't have enough gold even to pay its bills. So then they wound up borrowing anyway. And they set up a central bank, which they wound up selling. 80% of it got privatized in the end because they needed the money. So they wound up with this public-private sort of central bank. So there was the first U.S. bank and the second U.S. bank, and then there was no bank for a while. So meanwhile, most of the money supply was created by private banks, just the way it is today, by fractional reserve lending. In other words, the banks would issue many times more banknotes than they actually had gold to back these banknotes, and that's how the money supply was expanded. So they got control of the money supply, and the government had to borrow from the bankers. They borrowed money that they could have printed themselves interest-free, and instead they had to borrow from private bankers at interest and had to pay it back. So that's how we originally were beholden to the bankers. And then there were third parties that were all about money reform. In the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln went back to the paper script of the colonists called greenbacks. So he issued these greenbacks in order to fund the Civil War. But he was assassinated and the greenbacks were discontinued. And so for the next several decades, they had one depression after another because of this collapse of the money supply. And the populace almost won with William Jennings Bryan in the 1890s. But after that, it was pretty much a two-party system that Democrats and Republicans, both of which were big money, Rockefeller, Morgan interests. Actually, according to Nomi Prinz, there were six big banks and six big banking families.
Dominated politics for like over a century, right? And there were no third-party candidates because they didn't have the money, right? They had no chance of going up against the moneyed parties as now.
Right, and then the whole country got so big, and then we got into television, where most people get their news from the television. Well, there's no way that you can reach this entire continent of people if you can't afford to get on television, and third parties just can't afford that.
So I just think it's very interesting that you pointed out that the demise of even the notion of having a democracy being so early sabotaged by the private control of currency and the issuance of credit in the hands of a few, and how nothing seems to have changed. I mean, you look around the world, and the things we've been talking about the last several weeks about Iceland and Ireland and Greece, all part of the same problem, that the singular control of issuing money in the hands of private parties is the thing that keeps people away from the whole possibility of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on their own terms, right?
Right, and the implication or the thought, the belief is that you have to borrow the money from the people who have it, and the people who have it are the big banks. But the catch, the fraud, is that the sleight of hand is that they didn't have the money either. They just printed it, or they just issued it as digitally on their book, and then we borrow it, and then we have to pay it back at interest. And, of course, the interest isn't created in the original loan. So you have this giant pyramid scheme or Ponzi scheme where you have to have more and more creditors or more and more debtors at the bottom to support the system. And then you've got these exponential numbers that you wind up with this whole derivative scheme that's numbers that are impossible to repay that have no relationship to the real economy or real productivity. So we have to somehow get rid of that whole parasitic system that's just sucking money out, where everybody is in debt to something that didn't exist in the first place.
I was really surprised to see that founding forebears of the country were so clear about the potential devastation of the private control of capital
and how bankers, at least banker interests, were able to consolidate and affect the future of the country. You know, the minute you give the country over to the bankers and let them control your currency through inflation and deflation, then you know you're going to be living in a country where the bankers will take over the assets, and your kids will be out on the street. And like that. Well, you know, this is where we live now. This is exactly what has happened. And that was 200 years ago. And that sequence goes like waves. They're up and down, up and down, up and down, all at the effect of the agenda of the private banking control or currency control.
What I thought was interesting in Job Cobb's paper, he pointed out that even when big money was in control of the government, there was some semblance of a democracy until we had globalization. So we got to the point where these big corporations were bigger than governments, and they really no longer had an interest in preserving borders, that they are opposed to governments generally. So they really have no need for the people, basically, at all. I mean, they're and no need for government other than to just control it in their own interest.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting point in your article, that it's finally come to its full dystopic end. This thing seems to be now consuming itself. When you say they have no interest in having people, but doesn't that's not viable, right? I mean, they have to have people to prop up their profit centers, don't they?
Well, they have to have people in India. They don't necessarily have to have people in the U.S. That's the problem. So they don't need to protect their own people. And so they're not really necessarily interested in providing for their people at all.
You've got a very interesting guest this week, Carl Herman. Do you want to tell us a little about what your conversation is about with Carl?
Well, one thing really interesting about Carl is that he's a teacher. I first met him at the American Monetary Institute conference, where he was giving a lecture on monetary reform issues, and I just thought he was really good at explaining things. So if you're a teacher, you know, you have to say these things over and over. So it's a skill that I would like to learn myself, because we keep finding ourselves bumping our heads against this wall of either denial or confusion or misunderstanding. I mean, the things that are so obvious to us because we've spent years looking at them just are not obvious to most people. So anyway, that's one reason he's really interesting, but he's written some interesting.
Yeah, and going to that, I mean, Noam Chomsky, they're talking about what people don't know through the media, but also through education. And he was just saying that in talking about some of what George Orwell's admonishments to the Brits and others who were getting smug about their perceived democratic freedoms, Orwell told them to not feel too self-righteous because, as he puts it, in England, unpopular ideas can be suppressed without the use of force, and certainly education and the media are part of that. So it'll be interesting to hear Carl Herman, the teacher, teach us a thing or two.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Ellen.
My guest today is Carl Herman. Carl teaches economics, history, and government, and has written extensively on money reform issues on Washington's blog and other places. He helped grow a citizens' lobby group called Results, which lobbied for U.S. policy to end poverty and delivered over 300 briefs to Congress. He turned to citizen journalism in 2005 to document crimes centering in war and money, along with solutions for a brighter future. Carl has a master's degree from Harvard in education and is quite skilled at getting monetary issues across to students, which I have found myself can be a challenging pursuit. Great to talk to you, Carl.
Great talking to you, Ellen. Thanks for having me.
I first met you at a conference that was sponsored by the American Monetary Institute. It was 7 or 8 years ago, quite a while ago. And you were giving a presentation on money issues, and I thought you were quite good at simplifying the complicated. So that's something I struggle with myself, how to get across the fact that our money is actually created by private banks, not by the government, and that if we want to get our government back and get our economy back, we need to take back the power to create money. Most people would choose that option. They would choose debt-free government-issued money if they knew it was an option, but they are clueless. People don't even know where our money comes from. So So I thought I would start there. How do you get the basics of money and banking across to your students? And why is it so difficult for people to get their heads around these concepts?
I'll start with the second one first. The best advanced placement economics coach of the teachers who teach that course, a guy by the name of Steve Reff, who has a website called Refonomics, R-E-F-F, he has also found in his experience that the one issue of how we create what we use for money is the single most difficult for students to understand. His option is to create a play for students to act out the roles with how money, what we use for money, is created. And I think it was maybe in 2008 that I introduced the 47-minute film Money as Debt as an option. And that has been the best tool that I've found to do this. And in terms of answering the question of why is it so difficult, I don't know. Steve doesn't know, but certainly from our experience of teaching is that that is difficult.
Yeah, I think it's because we've actually been taught it wrong. You see the faces of the presidents on the coins and the dollar bills, and you've been told that you've seen the printing press where they're printing these dollars, and so everybody just assumes that the government issues them basically for free. But we are never taught that that most of the money is created by banks, not by the government, and that the government has to borrow the money just like everybody else. I mean, they wouldn't. Under the Constitution, they could just issue it. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. But Congress abdicated that power, or delegated it, I guess they say, to the Federal Reserve without even knowing, I think, themselves what it was that they were giving up. I mean, there were all kinds of shenanigans involved with the Federal Reserve. Do you want to go into some of that?
Yeah, I'd love to. When anybody is educated in any domain, it seems that we come across the conclusion that there are lies of omission and commission that do give a false impression. And this money creation topic certainly is a excellent case study for this. Among advanced placement economics teachers, we do teach the facts of how what we use for money is created. But this is interesting, Alan, because among the teachers, I've been working with a discussion board. We have like 2,000 AP teachers around the world, and maybe a couple of hundred of them pay attention to the discussion board topics, which is really the leading edge teachers trying to help everybody understand the topic of macroeconomics and how to teach it. Ever since 2008, I keep on hammering at opportunities to point out the analysis aspect that you and I and many others work on, that the fundamental issue of what we use for money could be created debt-free for the direct payment of public goods and services. And this has a long history going all the way back to Benjamin Franklin discovering that you can operate a government without taxes by creating what you use for money as a public bank. And what I found, Ellen, is that the response among these teachers is, at my count now, after having hammered at it for maybe 7 years, is maybe about 20 of the teachers indicate from time to time some understanding of the trillions of dollars of power that we're pointing to. But the rest of them, they're this cognitive dissonance of not wanting to be responsible for this information seems to override the power of the fact.
I think it's going to be really difficult to, in the U.S., for us to change the laws, that particularly given our current Congress, which is going the other way. But I saw that Putin just managed to get back the power to issue money from their central bank. I mean, I had seen all this different writings saying that he couldn't get the central bank to issue act on behalf of the government, that it was an independent central bank, basically controlled by the international bankers, like most central banks are. But just recently, he has gotten the bank to issue the credit for a loan for some infrastructure project. So that's what we should be doing. We should either have our Federal Reserve do quantitative easing for infrastructure and education and social services and all those things we know we need. And anyway, it seems to me that we may wind up looking to Russia or China. We know China already does that, but they do it so discreetly that you can't exactly point your finger at it and say that's what they did. But Russia, I think, Putin is just coming right out and doing it. So we may just have to watch while other countries do it, and it works so well that then we'll get on board. My sense is that our current government really doesn't want to solve the problems of the poor. I mean, they really want to own everything and to rent it back to us. So they're using that for they're using the balanced budget argument for an excuse to get rid of what they call entitlements. And what I would say is absolutely an entitlement under the Constitution, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, basically the right to life. I mean, people will die if they don't get the basic welfare that you need if you don't have a job. And if they can't get a job, which is not their fault, then it's basically murder not to give them those basic social services.
Yeah, they really don't have an argument. One of my favorite quotes is economist Simon Johnson, the former chief economist of the IMF and now at MIT. He wrote a best-selling book, 13 Bankers, and he was interviewed by Bill Moyers, and Simon just said, look, we can't get anybody from the big banks to debate with us. They won't because they can't. They don't have any facts. All they got is money and lobbyists, so they can't come out and take us on the facts. I have a little pet project with my students right now of working with the newly elected mayor of San Jose, who promised to end homelessness. And you know, ending homelessness in all 50-plus cost-benefit studies shows that it saves money. And the city of San Jose said, we're going to take it on. My students know this, and the mayor promised it. So we checked, and we're working with one of the policy analysts of the mayor. And currently, they're funding about one-fifth of the problem to be solved. And our current status after about a month of communication is now we're asking the question, so you don't have the money to do this. And we offered to have a conversation about a public bank, but you kind of push that off. So what's the mayor's plan to get the money if you don't have it? And everyone else says they don't have the money. And we're giving them information about monetary reform and that the state of California could have a public bank issue the credit, solve the problem statewide. We'd have the employment, we'd solve the problem, and we'd start saving money right away. And we'll see how the policy analyst responds if he's bright and sharp enough to jump on that idea.
Yeah, talking about how difficult it is to get concepts across to people, it is really difficult getting across to politicians or elected officials, I guess we're supposed to say, the fact that banks actually create money. And if you own a bank, it's different from a revolving fund. It's different from just taking a pool of money that, you know, that you raise with taxes or that you have in some fund and lending it and then waiting till it gets paid back and then lending it again. That's a revolving fund. A bank actually creates money on its books. And if you have a bank, you can create money in the form of credit. So basically doubling your money. I just learned an interesting fact. I mean, that what they always say to me, what I'm running up against here in Los Angeles and working with some California officials, is that we don't have the money, you know, to capitalize a bank. But I just learned that a joint powers authority can be set up between several cities. Like you could take your cities where you live there, and the joint powers authority is an independent entity. It's a nonprofit corporation, I think, although it's government owned, and it can issue bonds. But the debt is not a debt of the cities. So if the joint powers authority goes bankrupt, then the city doesn't have to bail it out. It's an independent entity. So that would be a way to get the money, is to have your JPA issue bonds. Anyway, there are all those tricky issues. But the first hurdle to get over is to persuade these legislators why this is a great idea, why they really want their own bank, because they're thinking, well, you know, the Wall Street banks, they've been doing this for decades and they know what they're doing and we don't, and why should we try to get into the banking business? It's not really our business. But when you realize how much money you could save 50% on the cost of your infrastructure, because 50% of the cost of infrastructure goes to interest. If you own the bank, you get the interest back. And many other ways you could save all these fees. So speaking of that, I know one thing you've written a lot on is the CAFRs, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports. And we have said that that might be one way to capitalize a bank, a publicly owned bank, is with the money that's tucked away in these funds. It was actually Walter Burian that publicized the CAFR funds, so we should give a hat tip to him. But his figure is a little hard to verify, so I know you've really gone into the figures in depth. So I wondered if you would explain what those funds are, why they're there, why they're not being spent, and how much money we might be able to tap if we tapped into them.
Yeah, I found out about Walter's work 4 years ago, and I read the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, for the state of California, for the city of Los Angeles, and for the county of Los Angeles. They're all structured the same, and if people want to take a look at it, it takes a couple of hours to go through, and almost all the data, it's not really worth anything, but there are big numbers that do jump out. This is what I found in the 2012 CAFR, and I have a 22-minute interview that InfoWars did, which is an article where I document everything that I'm about ready to tell you. Just look up CAFR, C-A-F-R, Carl Herman, H-E-R-M-A-N, and I give a CAFR summary. And this article title is, "A $600 billion fund can't fund a $27 billion pension or a $16 billion budget deficit. Why have it?" So the state of California has about $600 billion that they disclose openly in taxpayer assets, in cash and investments. Most of that, about $500 billion in magnitude figures, the last time that I read this thing in the 2012 report, goes to pay for retirement accounts, so-called pension funds. But then if you dig a little bit deeper, Ellen, it's really revealing that the $27 billion cost for the pension program only gets a net $1 billion income from the $600 billion that we have all put together, or the $500 billion specifically placed to pay for investments. Now, that's crazy stuff.
So that's one-sixth of 1%? Am I calculating that right?
Yes. We pay the Wall Street experts $2 billion for their advice, but we end up with a net $1 billion from that investment strategy. And all this is right out there in the open for anybody to go ahead and find out. And in the summer of 2012, I thought I'd get myself in trouble and contact my state representative, both in the Senate and the Assembly. And I know both of these individuals, Carol Liu, who we met with, and Anthony Portantino. And I called up their offices and said, "Look, I'm going to ask deceptively simple questions. So here's what I found. I just want you to verify that this data is correct on your own financial statement, and that it's possible to reconsider this funding structure." And the safe answers would be, yes, I'm correct, because I think that I am. And the numbers are right there. If I'm wrong, let me know. And the second answer would be, yeah, it would be possible to reconsider it. I don't want you to commit to reconsidering it, but just that it would be possible. But what I found after 6 weeks of obfuscation, both offices, eventually after handing me off to several people, including the chief of staff, they wouldn't confirm their own financial data. They wouldn't give me a simple yes or no that you're right. They wouldn't give me a simple, yeah, it would be possible to reconsider it. Instead, they finally delayed and delayed and delayed while I kept writing articles. And finally, after this interview that I had with InfoWars, they both publicly came out with their response. No comment.
Well, my guess is they're very busy, and those aren't really their numbers from their office. They would have to go track it down with some other office. They take the report at face value. but they just don't see the significance of it. I think that's our challenge, is getting across to these elected officials the great opportunity that they're missing by not using those funds for some other purpose or not setting up their own bank, which actually could be done very quickly. I mean, there are all these arguments for why they shouldn't do it, but what we haven't managed to get across to them is why they should do it, to really excite them about what the possibilities are. Now, I think, for example, Greece may be about to do it because they don't have any other option. That's what it's when crises occur that legislators perk up and start seeing what the possibilities are out there. Greece, according to the UK Telegraph, it is rumored that they are likely to leave the euro rather than not pay their people and not do the social services that they're committed to, the Syriza party. So if they leave the euro, then they will be setting up their own, they'll be nationalizing the banks, which they have to do because the banks will effectively be bankrupt. They won't be able to get euros. The ECB won't back them. So they'll have to set up their own banking system and go back to the drachma. And it'll probably be like Iceland. They'll suffer a lot in the beginning. The drachma will lose value and the banks will lose customers. But Iceland now is doing very well. I mean, you just have to get through that difficult adjustment period, and then the possibilities are there before you. So we may just have to watch these other countries and these other models in order for our legislators to get inspired about what they could do.
Yeah, and there's only so much that we really can do, Ellen, and I think that you're doing a great job, and I'm doing the best that I can, to as confidently in these numbers and the figures and the mechanics lay out the argument that there are possibilities that are right there for anybody to verify for solutions with the power of having your own bank, with the power of monetary reform, but people got to be willing to step up and explore and understand and then exercise their authority to try this stuff out.
Well, I have one more question. I actually have to speak at San Diego State University on April 16th on a panel about our democracy and about third parties. It's actually sponsored by the Green Party. And so I was doing some research on it, and I read a study from Princeton University that said that we are no longer a democracy, that we're actually an oligarchy, that Congress does not respond to the will of the people. It responds to the will of big money, and more specifically to the will of Wall Street. So as a historian, I wondered if you could go into how that happened. What went wrong? Did the founding fathers leave something out of the Constitution, or did it get stolen from us while we weren't looking by sleight of hand, or how did that all evolve?
Well, the history of it is fascinating. The founding fathers' research, James Madison, spent the winter before the Constitutional Convention researching the writing and consideration of the failed democracies in Greece and Rome. And the founding fathers, I think, in good faith effort, and we can tell this from the strength of their admonitions that even though they're giving us a structure that they think gives us a fighting chance, we have to be responsible to not allow oligarchs to steal and subvert what I think is crystal clear rights that are spelled out in the United States Constitution and very well accepted and embraced ideals in the Declaration of Independence. It has been stolen by us, and everything that we've been warned about for Orwellian language is coming into play. Now, I do have a couple of resources that I teach to my own students in government and economics, and these are published on Washington's blog, which gives the best historical frame that is easy to understand and to verify and for people to see for themselves that we were given this chance of a constitution, and what we have now is not even close to the honoring of the constitution in letter and intent. That article title is just called Teaching Critical Thinking to High School Students, And there's a whole series that centers in government, and there's a series in economics, which go through economics history with how we lost the money power and how easy it is to see when you look at the mechanics that, yeah, we should be having public banks and debt-free money. The specific advanced placement economics assignment that I have for money creation, which goes into the mechanics a little more deeply, is called debt-damned economics. Either learn monetary reform or kiss your assets goodbye.
Great title. And I think one way that we've lost our democracy is that education has been subverted. Like the whole history, our whole history has been subverted. So originally the colonists issued their own money and they were independent of England and were able to, or independent of the Bank of England and the bankers, and were able to just pay for the things they needed, and they thrived. I mean, they did remarkably well. People were in England were remarking at how amazing it was that that these colonists had turned a wilderness into productive, fertile land. But they did tend to inflate the currency. That was a problem, where if you just print and print and print, I mean, it was all experimental, and they probably didn't realize that was going to be the result until it was. So those currencies tended to devalue. But even so, they did many things that they couldn't have done otherwise. And then Pennsylvania, the Quakers of Pennsylvania, came up with a system where they actually owned a bank. And so instead of just printing and spending, they printed the money and lent it to the farmers. So then it came back, so it circulated. And then they printed some extra, so they didn't have the problem of the interest not being available to pay principal and interest when the bank only created and lent the principal. So it was a totally sustainable system that the currency did not inflate. They paid no taxes, and the government did not go in debt. So it was really an ideal system, but you never read that in the history books. I mean, I really had to dig to come across that at all. So in some way, our education has gotten subverted, and obviously our mass media are subverted. You don't really hear the real story on TV, and that's where most people get their news. I have to admit, that's where I got my news when I was a busy housewife and raising kids and trying to be a lawyer all at the same time. I would just turn on the TV for 5 minutes just so I wouldn't sound like an idiot at dinner, and that's all I knew about what was going on.
Yeah, Harry changed. Great line in his autobiography, the only thing new in this world is the history you didn't know.
Right, and there's so much of it. But I think it takes leisure to even get into that. Most people, I mean, even my own relatives, they really don't have the time to worry about these things. They figure, well, I can't do anything about it anyway. Why should I bother to even read about it? They're more concerned about, you know, relationships and their job and just getting the basic housework done. And by the time they've gotten through the day, they're so tired, all they can do is turn on the TV and just have a beer or whatever and sort of space out and go to sleep. So partly it's our work ethic that is at fault.
Yeah. The good news that I frame is that this is really Emperor's New Clothes obvious, and that historically when there have been revolutions against oligarchs, the time frame from having control over this Emperor's New Clothes paradigm versus the revolutionary action that fully reveals the hypocrisy is relatively brief. It happens in a heartbeat. So we'll just keep moving forward in good faith effort, and we'll discover altogether what evolves.
Yeah, well, I think our salvation will be the internet. I mean, despite all these problems, I'm actually very optimistic. I think we may have to wait for other countries to prove the model, but ultimately I think we are evolving toward a beehive mentality. In other words, well, my daughter, Jamie, is into this whole biomimicry model of imitating nature, that if you follow nature, a young species begins as individual single-celled organisms that sort of compete with each other, and then they become single individuals competing with, you know, single animals competing with each other. But ultimately, they become what are called superorganisms, where they actually feed each other, and that is the only sustainable the system when you get really large. So you have bees and termites and or fungi. I think they are super systems, that they're all connected in the earth. And there are trees, for example, that go for 1,000 miles, and it's all one tree. I mean, it's a forest, but the trees are connected in their roots down below. So they're all feeding each other. And that is the system I think we are tending toward, and that we have to evolve in order to be sustainable. Obviously, this 1 quadrillion or more of derivatives is not sustainable. I mean, what we have is something that's this mathematical construct that's just growing on its own without any relationship to reality and the way actual resources grow. So it has to ultimately destroy the system unless we revise the system, and hopefully we'll do that before we destroy the planet.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Do you have any other further thoughts you'd like to add?
Just to encourage people with this, we all are connected, and there's evolving work in physics that I work with a group of people called the Resonance Project with unified field theory, where in physics we can actually demonstrate that everything seems to be provably mathematically connected, and we just need to catch up with our ability to tap into that connectedness. And if people pursue what's important to them, I think in that's all that we really can do. We could surrender to the oligarchs, but that really isn't a conscious choice that 99% would make. So we just move forward in good faith effort, and we'll find out.
Yeah, agreed. Well, it's been really nice talking to you, Carl.
Good talking to you, Ellen. Thanks for your work.
We've been talking to Carl Herman, a contributing author at Washington's Blog.
When you start looking closer at how much it costs American taxpayers to continue to do business with Wall Street from a municipal standpoint, the numbers stagger the imagination. Fully $4 trillion each year are given to Wall Street to manage the costs of municipal business. The group Communomics USA is bringing this situation into focus in a new effort designed to educate America's mayors to alert these city representatives to the troubling scale of financial cost that results from partnering with the global banksters. We spoke with Ira Dember, a co-founder of Communomics USA, who wrote a document intended to open this thread of awareness for the mayors, who have been having to deal with the growing expense of servicing their debts for quite a while.
It's been a fairly long-standing problem, Walt. The city of Los Angeles has been paying $200 million a year just in fees, financial management fees and related costs to Wall Street.
And you point out that the municipal finance services amounts to, what, a $4 trillion business?
The total of municipal finance, right. It also includes certain types of bond financings that are, let's say, unconventional. Just as Wall Street came into the mortgage market and created a lot of quote-unquote unconventional mortgages that basically ended up screwing people because they were complex and filled with risk that homeowners did not understand. Wall Street essentially duplicated that model, primarily the big banks and hedge funds, with municipalities.
Give me an example of that, Ira. How does that work, a subprime loan, as it were, for municipal finance?
Okay. There are a certain type of financing called a capital appreciation bond, a CAB. A CAB is a classic case of a type of financing that many municipalities, school districts, and other tax jurisdictions went for because they were desperate for money. So they turned to these debt financings that Wall Street was only too happy to provide. And CABs and other types of financings, there's pension obligation bonds, POBs, mm-hmm. and the interest rate swaps and auction rate securities, they're called. All of these things are fraught with risks that are extremely complex and that even the professionals working for the municipalities did not understand and were reassured by these supposedly reputable Wall Street entities that, it'll work out fine.
Some of the municipalities have sued, haven't they?
And they have. And a few of them have won back a few million dollars.
Okay.
but the scale of the ripoff is enormous. And that's not even going back to the to our original thought about fees. You know, they charge what the traffic will bear. And because the big banks are basically a cartel when it comes to municipal financings, they get to charge basically whatever they want.
I notice in your resolution that financial fees, and not interest, now comprises 70% of the income at three of the largest municipal finance service providers. That's up, it's up about 70% in the last 10, 15 years. And the largest municipal finance service providers are, that's another word for the largest banks, is that correct?
Basically, yes. There are other players involved that are all in on what I call the grand scam. Those include the bond rating agencies. They include special firms or subsidiaries that basically, you know, shop for bond underwriters for you, things like that. But they're all in on it.
Another fact of this, from what I understand, is that if a city want to get out of these situations, there are fees involved, right?
Oh, the fees are enormous. The banks have them basically locked in. And some municipalities, I believe, have gone to court to say that the penalty for getting out of these deals are excessive. But those penalties are set so high. They were designed, of course, to keep you in the deal, to lock you into the deal. Wall Street basically is a cartel that keeps them locked in.
What are you proposing that they could do as municipalities to protect themselves?
Well, mayors could get together and explore among themselves the possibility of negotiating jointly with the big banks to drive down the fees, to say you're not just dealing with one city, you're dealing with two or three or 20 or 200 cities, and you're negotiating with us as a unit. You're not just talking to us individually anymore.
Part of that process is to identify what you consider unfair practitioners, right? Unfair dealings, unfair practices, to first of all discover who's
that
doing that and put them on a blacklist, maybe.
Something like that. That would be up to the mayors themselves. Mayors could choose to come together and explore these possibilities.
Yeah, and of course, you know, mayors are really are on the front line of change, economic change in the country, since the major capitals and all the state capitals in Washington seem to be unconcerned with how cities and towns are making their way forward, that it's the mayors who are leading some of the more creative charges around the country. I noticed that the mayors explore more equitable, reliable, and trustworthy financing and management models. An interesting idea that they might be able to serve themselves and maybe creating their own public banks would be an excellent financial opportunity for them to address this issue.
Mm-hmm. We want mayors to empower themselves, just the way workers empowered themselves in earlier generations. They could decide to get together and launch their own public banks jointly with other cities and towns. That could be very powerful.
That's for sure. Well, Ira, thanks, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Walt. I really do believe that if the mayors do empower themselves by banding together and taking joint action, it could be a game changer for this country.
That's Ira Dember, co-founder of Commonomics USA, speaking about an initiative that's focused on educating and mobilizing American mayors about the true costs and alternative methods that are available to them to reduce the excessive expense of dealing with Wall Street banks for municipal finance. For more information about Commonomics USA, go to commonomicsusa.org. Today on the Public Banking Report, Matt Stannard takes a look at how folks around the world are defending their rights to sovereign banking institutions, that is, to protect themselves from oligarchic control of their money. It's valuable and interesting to see how our efforts in the U.S. to reclaim control of our money are being mirrored actively by our neighbors in countries near and far. That's a sign of good democratic health. Here's Matt.
We've talked a lot lately about the exciting momentum of the public banking movement in the United States. We know that there are bills, burgeoning initiatives, feasibility studies, and campaign promises around public banking in states from Hawaii to Pennsylvania, from Maine to New Mexico. In this segment, though, I'm going to tell you about efforts in other countries to protect, restore, and enable finance and banking in the public interest. And hopefully, I'll leave you thinking about what Americans can learn from other nations' experiences. Let's start with our neighbors to the north. In Canada, what began as a long-shot lawsuit has become a mighty legal struggle. The renowned Canadian attorney Rocco Galati is representing the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform in a suit designed to make the Bank of Canada live up to its original promise as a public bank. Here's the story. The Bank of Canada was nationalized in 1938 and is wholly owned by the Canadian people. Between 1938 and 1974, the federal government borrowed at low or no interest from the bank. But all that changed in 1974 when Canada turned to monetarism, a paradigm holding that expansion of the money supply is inflationary, a paradigm that was a partner to neoliberal economic policy. This shift compelled the federal government to borrow from private foreign banks to finance Canada's pension plan and a whole host of other public projects, from transportation to healthcare, airports, seaports, and more. In the 40 years since, Canada's privatization of finance has led to an unprecedented level of public debt. It's commodified and effectively privatized the human capital expenditures originally articulated in the Bank of Canada's charter. So in 2011, the Committee for Monetary and Economic Reform and two private citizens sued the Canadian government. The plaintiffs alleged that the Bank of Canada is the only central bank among the G8 countries that is a public bank, created by statute, accountable to the legislative and executive branches of government. They also argued that the bank's secretive dealings and particular accounting practices further undermine the ability of the government to meet its constitutional obligations to provide economic security to the Canadian people. Now, so far, the Canadian courts have heard numerous procedural arguments from the Government of Canada, and knock on wood, the plaintiffs' claims have survived. The government had until March 29th to appeal the last federal court decision upholding the plaintiff's standing and allowing them to amend their claims. The government did not appeal, but we'll see what other tricks the Crown has up its sleeve. If the plaintiffs win, and that's a long way away, these are just procedural appeals, but if the plaintiffs win, it would constitute an official mandate that the bank of one of the most powerful countries in the world is indeed a public bank. And that would be an unprecedented victory for economic justice. Let's turn to Germany. Now, Germany, of course, already has public banks. They have 11 regional public banks called Landesbanken and several municipal public banks for consumers. These banks have been very successful in carrying out the specific mission of public banks, funding municipal services, small businesses, infrastructure, and the public good. Last November, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, the European Central Bank took over direct supervision of over 100 of Europe's largest banks. This included some of the German Landesbanken. So one of those banks, the development bank Landeskreditbank, filed a lawsuit with the European Court of Justice, the European Union's highest court, seeking to free it from European supervision. L Bank, as the bank is known, claims that the regulations that the ECB is imposing will make it harder for the L Bank to lend money to businesses and families. Like the Bank of Canada lawsuit, this is the first of its kind. It's the first legal challenge to the ECB's supervisory role. And the challenge is radical. It's not coming from a big private for-profit bank that might claim European supervision undermines free enterprise. Instead, the claim, and it's a cogent one, is that the EU's quest for control over all aspects of banking undermines public banks' role in financing the public good. And the L Bank is right about something else, too. They aren't like the big private banks in need of regulation. They aren't corrupt. They don't feed off the public trough. Rather, they give back. According to the Wall Street Journal, in 2013, L Bank supplied 7.4 billion euros in low-cost credit to support local projects, businesses, and families. You know, in many ways, the battle between the L Bank and the European Union reminds me of the dilemma faced by community banks in the U.S. under the Dodd-Frank regulations. Those regulations are meant to keep big Wall Street banks honest, but they're being used to strangle small community banks who've never been responsible for creating any economic crises. Now, our first two examples concerned legal challenges to insensitive national and regional policies concerning banks. Our third story moves from the judicial branch to the legislative, or more accurately, the parliamentary. Come with me to beautiful Iceland, where, according to the Telegraph and Agence France-Presse, the Icelandic parliament is considering a proposal to remove the power of commercial banks to create money, instead giving that power to the nation's central bank. This would be truly revolutionary in the history of modern finance. It would fulfill the call of many activists, not the least of whom is Ellen Brown herself, who's repeatedly argued that the creation of money and the lending of credit should be public utilities rather than private commodities. Iceland has had over 20 serious financial crises in the last 100 years, most recently, of course, in 2008. Each and every one of these crises was perpetrated by the ballooning of credit by private banks. Now, in the status quo, the central bank can only try to minimize the damage of that ballooning credit, but under the new proposal, which is called the Sovereign Money Proposal, Iceland's central bank would become the only creator of money. Banks would continue to manage accounts and payments and would serve as intermediaries between savers and lenders. Now, these battles all have one thing in common. They challenge the tired neoliberal narrative that big banking business can run the economy. After untold suffering and countless crises, we know they can't. But Wall Street and big private banking have dug their claws in so deep that they control large portions of the lawmaking process itself all over the world. And the problem is so bad that regulatory efforts to rein in the big banks can't help but hurt the small banks. These struggles, and the further struggles they inspire, could change all of that. And even if these efforts fail, they've at least paved the way for further efforts. They've helped us develop a legal and policy vocabulary for economic democracy. That's what movements like this should do. After all, it's our money.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.